Welcome to this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry, only on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk, proudly sponsored by Battleborn Tree Service, Truck Envy, Shooting Performance Institute, and Rightful Liberty Arms. Go get your hats at Rightful Liberty Arms. All you got to do is a purchase $50 or more. So basically nowadays, that's a box of ammo. So go get some ammo. Everybody knows what they have in their pocket right now. So for those of you that drew one of those coveted rifle tags, go see Michael at Rightful Liberty Arms and then go see Jim at Shooting Performance Institute and get tuned up. I have a special guest in studio today, Aaron Lamfante from Battleborn Bird Dogs, a repeat retread recycled guest. Aaron, you were coming in hot off the heels of your state shoot.
Yes.
Sporting Clays.
Yep.
Where you shot 410.
Yeah.
I learned from Rick Carter, who is a guest on the show. Rick shot the 12-gauge stuff, so he shot like 3-4 days.
Yeah.
Shot his best morning score ever, a 90.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Basically, I invited you on the show to talk about how good Rick is and just make you listen to somebody else's accolades. No. So you shot well yourself.
Yes.
You went up, what, 30-something
yep,
out of 30. 50.
Yep.
Okay.
Tied for second.
Tied for second
in the D class.
You had to add that caveat. Yeah. You know what the best part about this show is, Aaron? Nobody understands any of that stuff. So I'll just say like, yeah, I took third at this shootout in Fallon for archery stuff. And people go, oh, Henry knows what he's doing. I don't have to get into the whole like, yeah, but it was in basically like the Special Olympics class, right? So you could have left it at, I took second.
No, it's okay, man.
You hit your goal.
Yes.
However, as we were talking about before the show, they set the course for 410.
Correct.
And Rick talked about that as well. He said the subgauge, they set it up differently. So does that change your goal going into it?
Yeah, I want to shoot higher than 50%. Like you and I had talked that when I enter these events, usually they're 12-gauge events, and you and I have gone to one together. And that was a lot of fun.
It was something.
And I always try to shoot at least 50%. I'm not quite there yet for those 12-gauge shoots because those targets are quite a bit further out. But for this event, the 12 was on a different days, but they set the 28 and the 410 together, and then they had different stands to stand in for the 28.
Okay.
The presentation was different for the 28 gauge, but the targets were kind of the same for the two gauges, sub gauges.
Yeah, was it a radical departure from how the course is normally laid out?
Yes, they had a ton of throwers there. In fact, I went after on Sunday to ask if I could shoot because I wanted to shoot the 12 gauge course.
Right,
and they had already started taking down all the throwers and everything on Sunday.
Gotcha.
After you and I had text.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
I want to go see what's going on because I wanted to shoot it because it looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And the 410 course was a lot of fun.
There's only so many presentations they can do, right? However, did they keep it in line with the course as far as like, you know, this corner is this normally this type of presentation?
No.
So we're going to have that, but different.
No, they had different throwers in different locations. So people like me who shoot that course a little bit frequently and like yourself, like there was things I was expecting, but they had throwers in different spots. And different areas.
Oh, so totally different. Oh, okay.
So that's why it was fun.
Not just an angle and speed change.
No.
Oh, okay. So very cool.
It was a lot of fun.
So you shot 50 targets.
Yes.
How does that look from a course layout? Because there's 15 stands, right?
So stations, I think it was stations 2 through 9 were set up for the 410 and the 28 gauge. And then stations 10 through 15 or 16 were set up for the 20 gauge.
Okay.
Those 2 days. And then for the 12 gauge, I think they just, the 410 and the 20 were done. So, and the 28, all the sub gauges were done. So the 12 was the main event. So they shot the Super Sporting, which is a 100+ targets.
Yeah. That's what Rick shot in. Yeah. So they just have you, why the 50 though?
I don't know. You would have to ask them. I just recently started shooting at these tournaments.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think it's because there were so many events and unfortunately Capital Clays is small.
Oh, it is a small, yeah.
Yeah, so they had to get creative on how they were going to host that event, I would imagine. I don't want to speak for them, but I mean, that's just looking at the course and how they set it up. It's a small event. A lot of people were surprised that they were able to host it, but I think they did a pretty good job. I've never been to a state tournament shoot before, so that was my first time.
Oh, this was your first?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So this whole thing, I thought you shot these type of things regularly.
No, I signed up for like the registered events, like you and I shot, I do sign up for those, but I never go to like a state shoot or anything like that. I just decided to go this year.
How long have you been doing the tournaments thing?
Only just a year, year and a
couple
half.
Years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I go to the non-registered shoots.
Right.
A lot, because I would just go with my son.
Yeah.
But then I started thinking, well, maybe I want to see how I stack up against everyone else. So last year they had a 410 shoot down in Gardnerville, a sub-gauge day. And that's, I met some really cool guys. I got squatted with them and we became pretty good friends, and they were really good shots. And I was right there in the mix of them. We shot 100, and I think I shot 72 or something like that. And
good so
I was
Lord.
Right in the middle of it all.
Okay.
But it was for like a D class, right? And the classes, I think, as we talked about, I think like you have to shoot X amount of targets to move up in a class.
Okay.
And you just start at D when you first start.
Yeah. So everybody, me walking in off the street, if I'm going to shoot in a registered deal, I'd walk in a D class.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So when you say shoot a certain number of targets, you're talking about breaking a certain number of clays over the course of a season?
I don't know if it's breaks or how many targets they, if it's out of 100, I think that just, you shoot 100 targets. Like whether or not you hit them, I think it's irrelevant.
Gotcha.
I think it's just the level, the number of registered target shoots that you attend in a year. So I think if I hit like 500, I think it'll bump me up a class. I'm not quite sure how it works.
Gotcha. Well, for your sake, I hope. No. With the time we have left, you're shooting a 410.
Yes.
We have had our discussions about the ammo.
Yes.
And the trash, was it YBR that we both bought?
Yeah, that was horrible.
Horrible stuff. What did you shoot for this tournament?
It was Winchester AA.
Winchester AA
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, those are super reliable rounds.
7.5, 8.
They were eights.
They were eights. Why eights?
I think that gives me the best. Like nines, I think, are a little that further distance for a 410. Nines just don't carry as much energy.
Okay.
They just don't pattern well. I think eights is like the sweet spot. 7.5 does carry further, but I don't have as much shot.
Bingo.
So I just think like swarm of bees, like how I want to attack that thing.
Yeah. Who else uses that? I've heard that phrase used before by somebody talking about chucker loads and why they choose to shoot a smaller shot size.
Yeah.
It's basically more impacts on target, essentially. Yeah. And they used a similar phrase. I don't think it's swarm of bees, is something else. Anyway, out of my mental meandering. So you shot the double A's, eights. What about chokes?
I shot a skeet and a medium choke.
And you didn't change modified for the whole tournament?
No, I left them in, yeah.
Skeet and modified.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, did you do any barrel selection for certain targets where you wanted a tighter choke first or no?
No, I always shoot the skeet first. It's the bottom barrel. I've never switched for that. I'm not, if you can, I don't know that I'm that advanced. I just pull the trigger.
Yeah. Okay. I did the show with Rick. And he was talking to me about that, and he said, you know, for all the mental sweat that goes into, and he shoots, you know, he's going to go shoot Quail Point over there, California, all that stuff. He shoots, he said, at sea level, a mod and a mod.
Oh, wow.
And that's it. That's all he runs. And then at elevation, so here, Carson Valley and stuff, across a lot of the Mountain West, he shoots just IC and IC.
Yeah.
And he does not change. And he said he sees guys doing the spinning at every station and this, that, and the other thing. He said if they would just stop and go through their pre-shot routine and go through hold point here, hold point here, hold point here, here's where I'm going to break and do that, he said they'd probably shoot a lot better.
I agree with that. I think sometimes I look at that and wonder if I should do that, but it's just a rabbit hole I don't want to go down. If I can hit it with this choke, then I can hit it.
Yeah.
And if I can't, then I'm doing something wrong. I need to figure it out. I'm not going to change my chokes. It's not, I don't know if that's
going to
help
me. Yeah.
I don't think it's going to help me that much.
Why did you have, when I shot with you one time, you had like full and full in there or something?
Yeah. I had modified and light full. And
that was just based on the course that you were at?
Yeah. That Carson Valley course is a little bit further away. And that was a 12 gauge shoot. So a couple times I've gone to those courses and I shoot my ski and a modified. A 410 on a 12 gauge course, and it just doesn't have the reach.
Gotcha. So that makes sense.
To try to get those further targets, you know, further presentations. I'll definitely choke.
All right. More with Aaron Lamfante from Battleborn Bird Dogs. Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM. Welcome back to this Sunday's episode of Nevada Backcountry with special guest in studio, Aaron Linfante from Battleborn Bird Dogs. And Aaron, we covered the Nevada State shoot that you shot in a little bit. I know we've done it once on the show before, but I want to go through why the 410, what 410, and why you stick with it for hunting. Yeah, so he starts laughing.
Okay, I get that question a lot.
What gun are you currently shooting?
Browning 7.25.
And it's, I've got this, not same gun. I think mine's the Sporting. Okay. You have the field gun.
Yeah.
Talk me through the 30-inch barrels?
No, it's 28. It's a little bit lighter than yours.
Okay.
And it doesn't have the raised rib.
Why that one?
Well, it was the only one I could get. Because I had a friend that bought the gun out from under me that I had ordered. I don't know who that would have been.
We're going to get some emotional scabs today, folks.
Yeah. I needed a Browning, and I wanted a 7.25 because the internals are just built differently, beefier to shoot lots of rounds through.
Okay.
And so the Sporting was gone, so I just went and got the field from a different guy.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't get the other one quick enough.
In your friend's defense, he probably just walked into the shop and somebody sold it to him.
You can say that, but I remember having a conversation with my friend that weekend, like, man, this guy's ordered this gun for me.
Well, yeah, all right. It's a nice gun.
I shot him once.
Yeah, and so the internal's a little beefy. I will tell you, those guns are heavy.
Yeah.
Compared to my old standby, the Beretta 686, sure. 28 gauge, that sucker is a pig compared to that gun. Anyway, neither here nor there. And we talked about the chokes you shoot or shot for that course. Now you hunt with that gun as well.
Correct.
Why?
The ammo's light. I like that. The gun is light. Like, you know, you're out there hunting all day, and I mean, you don't use a 12 anymore. But when you did, you know, pockets full of 12s were heavy.
Oh, it was heavy, yeah.
And the 12 itself is heavy.
Yeah.
Field guns are a little bit lighter, but they kick a lot more. So it just, I don't know. Once I made the switch, I think I have that masochist mentality. Like, oh, you can't shoot with a 410. You know, I had a friend, that's how I kind of got into it. And I was like, well, he can't do something that I can't do, so I'm going to do it.
Right.
And then I just stuck with it. I knew I wasn't going to have success. It's such an exact gun.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have a lot of margin for error.
No, God, no.
And so I just like it. I like being able to hit things far away with my 410 consistently. Makes me feel good.
Yeah,
it's an ego thing, I guess.
Okay. Last year when we hunted together a couple times, you took a 28 gauge.
I did.
Yeah, because?
The Browning I had fell off the truck and I'd lost it.
In Montana.
Yes.
And that was the Synergy, which they don't make anymore in 410.
I cried.
Yeah. That was a much lighter gun.
Yes. And it had a raised rib, so it shot a little bit differently than the 7.25 that I have now. She probably shoots more like the gun you have.
Gotcha. Well, my scores at that shoot that we went to, notwithstanding, when I'm shooting that Winchester AA stuff, I'm usually neck and neck at the Carson course with my 28 gauge, despite the fact that I'm throwing not, I don't know what those target loads are, 5/8 of an ounce or something, half ounce, something like that. Yeah. So, I mean, I love that gun. I love shooting it. I do not know that I would hunt with it. Not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron's giving me a look, folks. There's a lot of judgment.
You just don't know you're going to hunt with it yet. You're going to be hunting with it.
Looked at me full of scorn. Okay, maybe I will, Aaron. It's just heavy. I mean, it's just a heavy gun.
Well, we can switch. You know, you can check my field. It's a little bit lighter.
You know what I was thinking about doing? Cynthia, go ahead, turn off the radio. I was thinking about picking up a Beretta in 410.
Oh, yeah, those silver pins are super nice.
Yeah.
They shoot really flat. I like them a lot.
They fit me well.
Yeah.
Which, everybody listening to the show, take this with a grain of salt. I don't shoot well enough to really actually understand gun fit or any of that. However, there are a few guns I've come across in my time hunting and where I pick it up, I feel like it just fits me and I shoot it decently enough. And that Beretta is one of them.
Yeah, for sure.
So I might give that Browning to Cynthia. She likes it a lot.
I have a pointer coming. You could certainly hunt with that.
Yeah, good. Speaking of which, this is way off the rails. Did he get in touch with you?
He did.
Okay, good. So you guys got that smoothed
over.
Absolutely.
And super. Thanks for that. And thanks to them for warranting the gun.
100%. Yeah. I'll give it.
Super reputable guys.
I was being coy about who it was, but Andy McCormick at Legacy Sports took care of you on a warranty issue with the gun. So shout out to Legacy Sports International. When you hunt, what are you shooting for? Shells, out of your 410?
It's 3-inch shells. I shoot sixes.
Okay.
And then I shoot eights and tungsten when I can find them. And then I have some bismuth that I sort of started using last year. And I like that a lot. Sevens and bismuth, it's amazing.
I'm shaking my head. It's not like you're going to put them in a museum. You might as well shoot them.
Yeah.
But you know, bismuth is gone.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah, I can't find it anymore. Yeah.
No, it's gone. And it has something to do with the war in Ukraine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There was some, I don't know if it's like because of the location of the mines or whatever.
Probably, yeah.
Has something to do with that. So companies are just saying no more. No more. There is no more bismuth to be had.
I read that somewhere, but I guess I didn't believe it because they were trying to promote copper loads, right? The copper,
Like,
oh, bismuth is getting harder to find, blah, blah, blah. Copper is the way to go. It's the same thing. I was like, okay. So
I think I saw a press release from Federal. I saw, who was the other one monkeying with bismuth? I think Kent, maybe? Is Kent under the Federal umbrella? I forget. Anyway, I've seen a couple different press releases now that essentially, yeah, bismuth is gone. I like tungsten, and I was talking to Rick about this when he was on the show. The bummer is even hand loading at home, that's about $5 every time, $6 every time I pull the trigger.
Expensive.
Yes. I save it for turkey stuff because I'm like, okay, I know for sure I'm going to hit this thing. Chucker and tungsten? Oof. Buddy,
that's expensive. I only shot the tungsten at geese.
Perfect. Yeah. That's a great use.
I shot it with my 410 and it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. And eights.
Yeah. No, okay. I think they were sevens.
Okay.
And I just choked up, full chokes.
Yeah.
Within 20 yards and it brought them down. I was really shocked.
Did you pattern it?
No.
No. Okay. Do you pattern your guns?
I'm not that rich.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it's super important. You figure out how your 410 shoots. That'll definitely help you figure out where the holes are in your pattern when you're hunting.
So we talked, you were giving me some grief before we sat down and I have not shot a lot. I've been traveling. Yeah. Woe is me. Right. But, I am bad about that, Aaron. I'm terrible about patterning guns, and I switch loads enough. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not true. My 28, I have my standard load that I've been doing forever with that thing. However, I don't know how it patterns. I got no idea.
It's like a data point that I think every shooter needs.
Okay.
But they don't do. I always get excited about going to pattern my gun, especially when I get a new gun, because I want to know where it shoots or if I'm shooting a new load that I've never shot.
You want to see what it does.
Yeah, I want to know so I can adjust for that. If I don't, then I'm just guessing if I don't know, and I don't like that.
What yardage do you pattern at?
30 yards.
30?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what was the old standard? 75% of the pellets in the 30-inch circle at 40 yards or something for waterfowl? Was that the deal?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I need to do that. Especially I think I've got aftermarket chokes in that Beretta.
Yeah.
No idea what those... You know, I just trust the manufacturer. I'm like, oh, yeah, this says light mod. Perfect. It's a light mod. I don't know.
You'll notice, too. I mean, like, you'll notice. If you understand the way your gun patterns, you're going to know, you're just know what shot does what and what chokes were good for what shot.
Right.
It's weird. I don't understand why it's not standardized somehow, but you put a different shell in with a different choke, and it patterns completely. I mean, obviously, it'll pattern a little bit differently, but not as much as you think, and then you see it on the paper and you're like, oh, that pattern's a lot differently.
Yeah.
Or a different shell with the same choke, like shells across the board will pattern differently. And I always think that's weird.
Yes.
So I always, when I hunt, there's certain shells that I really like that are sixes and lead and that I just know how they shoot in my gun. And
okay.
So I just always try to stick with that.
I was going to say, I make these blanket statements, right?
Sure.
And then I got to call myself out and say, well, no, that's a little bit of a lie. I do for turkeys.
Sure.
Pattern my guns for turkeys. Because I think about it in a much more, it's like a more of precision shotgun shooting. So I do that. And you're absolutely right. And it's not the constriction indicated on the choke tube is not always indicative of how it patterns
yeah,
with that
paper. Yep.
100%. So with an extra full turkey choke and a certain, I won't say a manufacturer, but load, I might as well be shooting it out of a cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's the wad and the choke interaction or what, but it's just absolute trash.
Mm-hmm.
I throw in a factory, like a mod, and that shell patterns like a, cantaloupe-sized thing at 30 yards. That's great.
That's awesome.
So anyway, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I do that for turkey, not for upland stuff, which maybe I need to. All right, we have covered guns. We've covered shooting, Aaron. Why I really brought you in here, I want to get all the dog training information out of you that I can for free without having to pay you. So stay tuned. Coming up, take a break, refill the coffee, grab a notepad and a pencil. We're going to get some free info out of Aaron Lenfante from Battleborn Bird Dogs. Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Welcome back to this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry. Thank you to Shooting Performance Institute, Rifle Liberty Arms, Battleborn Tree Service, and Truck Envy for sponsoring the show. Hopefully everybody got a notepad and pencil or pen over the break. I am here with Aaron Lenfante from Battleborn Bird Dogs. Aaron, I'm going to start picking your brain. I don't want you to give everything away for free, but I also think you work in a unique enough job or business where it takes that personal touch. So you could probably talk everybody through A to Z how to train a dog. At the end of the day, it's going to take Aaron Lenfante to actually pull it off.
Maybe.
I don't know.
What I do isn't magic, man. That's one of my mentors told me that. He goes, what we do isn't magic.
I think it takes a certain personality type, though.
I would agree with that probably.
Yeah. Here's where I want to start. We talked before we went to air. I've got a dog right now. I don't know why I say stuff like that. Fletch.
Yeah.
So Fletch, my setter, you trained him. Phenomenal dog. I like him. He's easygoing. He's a softer fellow. With a dog like that, I want him to retrieve birds. I'm getting to an age. Mm-hmm. Dixie, my older Brittany, will point dead birds. Occasionally she retrieves, mm-hmm. but there's no rhyme or reason to it. It's like sometimes she decides she wants to pick it up and bring it back. Other times she wants to just lock up on point at the bottom of a canyon where it died. So with Fletch, as I get older, I go, okay, here's a dog. He's softer. He minds well. He's would I be wrong in calling him an eager to please dog?
Yeah, he's a people pleaser for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've got this dog. I want him to retrieve my birds. I'm tired of hoofing it down to the bottom of canyons. Force fetch stuff. Mm-hmm. You were correcting some preconceived notions I had about force fetch, what it is, how it works, how often you have to do it, so on and so forth. So repeat everything you told me earlier and just give people a little, hey, my dog doesn't retrieve, but it is a trained dog. What can they be doing at home?
So the first misconception, right, is that force fetch is also for dogs that retrieve. The way I like to describe it to people is that force fetch is to produce a reliable retrieve. And it doesn't matter if the dog has inclination to retrieve or not. So that's why you force fetch a dog. Because I can force fetch a dog that likes to retrieve.
Right.
But you want that 100% of the time. So that's why you would force fetch a dog to get that reliable retrieve every time.
And that is something I want to do with Fletch.
Sure.
Now, the bummer is, as you told me, it doesn't stick. It's not permanent.
Yeah, it's something you have to keep up with, especially if a dog's not, you know, doesn't have that inclination to retrieve.
Okay.
I see it, and I've seen it over the years. Like, they kind of know what you want, but they're not really wanting to do it. They know you're not hunting, you know, so you have to, it's just a habit that needs to be reinforced on your part as an owner consistently with them.
Okay.
If you don't, then they'll just kind of forget it. I have a dog. I force fetched all my dogs, except for my pup right now.
Messy?
Yeah, I haven't forced. He just retrieves naturally.
Oh.
So I haven't really done a whole lot with that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and he's only a year. And so force fetch is also, the other thing about is people want me to force fetch like their puppy, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, that, and I try to tell them like they're two different ideologies there, right? So you want the dog to point and retrieve, or find birds and point, and then you want the dog to retrieve. So I typically don't do force fetch as part of like a pointing dog training.
Okay.
Like I take the dog, I teach him how to point and make him steady and staunch and, you know, steady to wing and shot and all these things. And then force fetch is the last part of that.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because I want them to do other things first and not be confused by force fetching. They're just different kinds of things. And so typically like when I train a dog to become steady, to break a dog out, right? Steady to, you know, point and shot and fall and all these things, it takes a little bit. Like the time I spend doing that during a session might be like 20, 30 minutes sometimes maybe 45 on a really long, it depends on how I set up the course that we're working, because I want the dogs to find the bird. If it's just bird work, if I'm just putting out birds on the list, the dog doesn't, it's maybe like 20 minutes. But for a force fetch, I try to keep the sessions when I'm force fetching the dog to absolute minimum. Like I don't, because they're doing something they don't naturally want to do. And I don't want to, you know, you can, I told you, you can like ear pinch, toe pinch, or you can use an e-collar on a dog to kind of
force them.
Yeah, motivate them, stimulate them to kind of do what you want a little bit. And for softer dogs, that doesn't really work. And they just lose interest. Dogs that don't really want to retrieve all day long will lose interest in this, game. And so you're just starting by just putting the dummy in their mouth, let's just say, and then you're just getting them to hold it for 10 seconds. And then you do that a couple times and you're done. I would just call it done.
That's
for
a
the
day.
Yeah, that's a day. Yeah, yeah. And then the next day would be 15 seconds. And then after they hold it, you know, hold the dowel in their mouth or the dummy for, I want to say like between 45 seconds and maybe a minute for me, and for every trainer it might be different.
Right.
Then I'll
right.
put the dummy on the other side of the table and see what happens. I'll just command them to go fetch that because they know I want them to hold it and put it in their mouth. So there's like these steps that you'll just build
building
upon.
Blocks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And it's not like you're not going to spend an hour, and it's not something that can happen in like a week. It's something you have to spend months to develop.
All summer, off season, which is why we're having this conversation.
Yeah.
This is stuff I want people to walk away from this episode with a few tips that they can be doing the off season. Yeah. Okay. So that's force fetch. And that's something I'm going to work on with Fletch.
Yeah, I'll help you with that.
Thank you. Thank you. Conditioning.
Yes.
Off-season conditioning.
Yeah. Super important.
I see a lot of out-of-shape dogs this time of year.
And owners.
And owners. And owners. What do you do for your personal dogs for conditioning outside of trucker season?
I try to replicate areas that I hunt. So behind my house, right, because it goes up to Virginia City from Washoe Valley, I'm always back there training. I will go on long walks with my dogs uphill.
Okay.
In the granite and in the DG that's all back there.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah.
And that conditions their pads.
Okay.
And I don't know if you had a dog, ever had a dog that's blown a pad, but it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to boot them up. And it seems like when I have dogs that blow pads, they just blow them their whole lives. Like there's nothing really I can do to prevent that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can buy the musher's putty and put it on their pads and stuff. And that helps a little bit, but it's not a cure.
And you're absolutely right. The dog that, and think of me what you want, I'm comfortable enough around you at this point. I'm going to say this. It was conditioning when I had a dog blow out a pad. And I feel like that pad never, and I tried every trick in the book, but it was always kind of a problem pad from then on. Yeah. And I think I really screwed the pooch, no pun intended, by conditioning too hard.
Yeah. I keep conditioning, especially during the summer months, like 20, 30 minutes.
Okay.
And I pay close attention to the temperature.
If it gets
above 80 degrees, then I really don't like to train dogs for conditioning. I need to be below 80. And then for only 20 minutes at a time. I have rig on, when I used to have a four-wheeler, I had a rig where I could road dogs.
Yeah.
Get them up. Like I'd have four dogs at a time. And we just would go on a five-mile
loop.
With
those like outrigger leash deals? Yeah.
And I have the same setup for my side-by-side.
Okay.
But mostly I've kind of gotten away from that. That was mostly for field trial dogs.
They
just have to be conditioned all the time.
Right.
For hunting dogs, I just kind of let them free run, and I'll be in my four-wheeler, or I'll walk with them, and we'll just run. I'll set a pace, like a range and a pace, and we'll just go. And then I'll have plenty of water for them and stuff. But it's super important. I would do that probably like 3 or 4 times a week. But pay attention, close attention to your dog.
I, at some point, got it in my head. I don't know if it was something I overheard or somebody told me. Run them on the asphalt on road surfaces, and it toughens up their pads versus like softer dirt. You're making a face like that's wives' tale.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've not found that to be true.
Okay.
Like I'll run that dog in varying terrain, but I mostly look for the DG.
Okay.
And I'll run them in sand because we have Washoe down there. So there's plenty of sand down there, and that toughens up their pads too. I'm not sure what running them on asphalt is going to do except for being hot.
Okay.
And they might be uncomfortable. I don't know. I don't know how that tons up.
Well, I do it first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
When it's like 5:30 in the morning. Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's getting up to 100 that day.
I think it's where you are. I think, just by nature, if you run on enough, I'm sure it's going to toughen up the dog's pad.
Okay.
But I don't think it's going to have the same effect as like sandstone, limestone, or the
cross country stuff.
Okay. DG that you're running in.
I'm happy that you said that because I hate running on the roads, but I do it because I add that thing in my head, like, oh, and I got a perfect 1 mile straight uphill my neighborhood, and it's exactly one measured mile. So I know, okay, I'm going to run up to that as fast as I can. I come back. Okay, there's my 2 mile loop. I'm not exhausting my dogs, but I would prefer to trail run.
I absolutely would trail run with my dog before I would run it on the pavement.
Well, I've been screwing up. So, all right, I'm making notes here as we go. So that's off-season conditioning. You're saying 3 to 4 days a week, no more than about 20-ish, 30 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, if you have dogs that swim, that's a great exercise for them as well.
Oh, yeah.
I think almost swimming is almost better than running sometimes because it just provides a cardiovascular workout for them.
Without beating up their joints. Well, same as human beings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
Really it is.
What about dogs that are Fletch doesn't like water?
You can get him in the water. He might not like to swim, but I think having a dog that is comfortable, because there's going to be, invariably there's going to be a point where you're going to shoot a bird and it's going to go across a canal,
right,
a creek, a river. Your dog's going to have to cross to get it.
Okay, so yeah, let me back up. He's not afraid of water, but he doesn't, like, he'll go bounce around and like lap some up and then he's out running. He doesn't want to stay and swim.
So when I have dogs that are like that, when I'm training them, I have a paddleboard and I'll just throw life jackets on them. And if they usually see me go out there and one dog goes out there, they'll figure it out and go out there.
They'll want to follow
you.
Okay. Dixie, I had the fortune, good fortune of having a lab when she was a puppy as well. So she doesn't know any better.
Yeah.
She swims like like a retriever. She's just like, this is what we do. We just get in the water and play. And I thought some of that would rub off on Fletch, but he's just more aloof for like, he's kind of like, I'll drink this. I'll get in it. But
I think if you got out in like a kayak or something and paddled out 50 yards from shore, I'm sure he would want to follow you out there. Like, he'll figure it out.
All right. Well, I might head down to Washoe before the algae bloom starts.
Yeah.
Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned. Final segment coming up. The show is Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Final segment of Nevada Backcountry on this Sunday. Thank you to all the show sponsors and those of you who take the time out of your day to listen. You can always go to 991fmtalk.com, click on the podcast tab. All the past episodes are available there. Don't be the guy that fact checks me constantly and goes back and says, hey man, on this episode you said this, and now on this episode you said, I'm a human being. I don't know. My moods change. My mindset changes. I don't have the greatest recall in the world, and I reserve the right. It's an opinion show, so I reserve the right to be wrong occasionally. Anyway, regardless, you know who you are. I love you. Thank you for emailing me constantly. I'm not right nearly half the time, man. Get used to it. We are going to wrap up with Aaron Linfante from Battle Born Bird Dogs. Aaron, I asked you about the Force Fetch program stuff, and that was super helpful. Now I want to ask you about gun-shy dogs. What I have always done with my dogs, and I got it from Richard Walters, W-O-L-T-E-R-S, his book Gun Dog. When did that come out? 60s, 70s?
Yeah, I have all those books.
Oh, you do? Okay. Yeah. Those were like the Bible back in the day. And
yeah, interesting books.
Thought there was... Well, I'll let you nitpick them in a second, but I thought there was something in one of them about like clapping shoes together, or like I use a 2x4, or even just loud hand claps before feeding a puppy. And they start to associate that noise with something pleasurable. Knock on wood, I've never had a gun-shy dog.
Mm-hmm.
Am I on the mark? Am I missing the mark? What do you do with gun-shy dogs?
Gun-shyness in a dog, like, usually just comes from, right, the dog being exposed to those loud noises kind of unexpectedly, like not being prepared, something happens, startles the dog, and then that habit's like repeat.
Okay.
So I think like I had a dog a while ago that I tried to fix, and I say try because when you try to fix a gun-shy dog, it's always hit or miss. It's never 100%.
Really?
Yeah, I've never been able to consistently like fix a dog, and then something will happen that I couldn't like train for to help it overcome its gun-shyness. It'll happen, the dog will freak out a little bit.
Okay.
You just kind of got to like reinforce the positive. But so for example, this dog that I had, this guy took his dog out, his pup, his 6-month-old GSP out with him and his buddies, and they all had 12 gauges and they went out chukar hunting. The dog kind of went on point, and then he and his four buddies just unloaded. And just
sounded like Normandy.
Scared the crap out of the dog, right? They didn't stop. They saw the dog was afraid, but they didn't stop. They thought more would be better. And so the whole day, it was just that, and the dog just didn't like it and just, you know, kind of collapsed.
Overused word nowadays, but traumatic for a dog. Yeah,
100%. And so to your thing about clapping, I think if you want to go that route, I think that's fine. I think you just need to be careful about how you introduce loud noises to a dog.
Okay.
I think, and that's what I pay attention to when I get dogs that have not been exposed to gunfire. I have my 209 primer pistols. Yeah. I have my 410. I have 12, you know, I work my way up, but I always start with the 209. And the way that I introduce a dog to gunfire is I get, and I think I have a video of this somewhere on my Instagram page too, where I had this young Vizsla, and I got him so excited about finding this pigeon flushed, and he's off like 50 yards away chasing that thing, and I'm firing my blank, and he's not even like flinching. Yeah. So it's how I introduce the gunfire to him.
Okay.
So something pleasurable for him, to your point, would be chasing a bird.
Yeah.
So he's doing something fun. I'm shooting the gun. He associates the gunfire with the bird. You associated the loud noise with food, something pleasurable. I think it's really just all how you introduce those loud noises to a puppy. And I don't know that there's a right way or, you know, there's no correct, like 2x4s. One reason I like to have puppies in my house when they're a young age and get them in the kitchen, they hear pots, pans, they hear loud noises coming out of the kitchen. My wife's constantly baking. So they hear the mixer, they hear the blenders, you know, they hear all these loud noises. So they become accustomed to the loud noises. And there's no like adverse reaction. They're just, that's just them in the kitchen. They're just making loud noises. They don't get freaked out by that.
Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah. Well, like I said, too, and I'm not trying to give myself credit, but I've just never had a gun-shy dog.
Yeah.
But then again, I also, we're loud people. I got a loud house.
Yeah, I've been in your house,
Yeah.
Well, to your point, like I think you thought about how to introduce those loud noises to your pup. Like you just didn't go out and not think about how you're going to do this with your pup. You like, and just start clapping 2x4s together, whatever.
Right.
And to scare your dog or to expose it. You thought about a way to do it. You thought about how to introduce it to those loud noises. And I think that's the preparation to that really led to your dog's success in not having issues with gunfire.
You make a great point too. I didn't think about this. I've been a sub gauge guy forever. Mm-hmm. I don't think my last three bird dogs ever heard anything bigger than a 20 go off.
Yeah.
So we weren't, they weren't out there as young pups and, you know, you're unloading with the 12 gauge and they just weren't around that stuff. So probably had an easier intro to it. You said you cannot fix reliably a gun shy dog.
I can't. Like I've never done that.
Okay.
It's about the situation and something has imprinted on that dog. He hears a loud noise and it instantly thinks of that unpleasant situation. And the way you undo that is get the dog to experience a positive situation with that loud noise.
Yeah. Imprint something over it. Yeah.
Correct. And so you just got to make it, not to sound too reductive, but you got to make it fun for the dog to hear a gunshot again is really what we're trying to do. And so I've always sort of want, cause you just don't know, like a dog, like I don't understand the dog's mind completely and how it thinks.
So
I don't know what would trigger it. You just go through enough repetitions and enough positive experiences with the dog so that hopefully forgets the bad experience that it had one time. But there might be a situation in where it startles, you know, the dog startles and then it gets scared and then it kind of reverts back to that for a second or for however long it is for that until that dog snaps out of it. You know, I don't know if you're a dog that has been even mistreated, right? It's almost the same kind of like mentality. You've got to coax that dog out of the way that it was treated to start reacting positively around people again. Or I've had dogs that have had too much use of the e-collar and they were great dogs, fun dogs, wanted to find birds. And I've had this happen where you put the e-collar on it and from prior trainers, they just used too much e-collar and the dog like just started shaking when it would point birds because it didn't know when it was going to get shocked. It just was such a bad experience for it. So you sort of have to undo all the negative experiences that the dog had with that situation. And sometimes they just don't forget every negative experience.
I just had this conversation, in fact, with a friend of mine. He mentioned something about introducing the e-collar stuff. And I said, man, that is one thing I have never done and I do not do because I've seen more dogs ruined with an e-collar than just, I think it's an invaluable tool.
It is.
You know, I mean, you know what I run my dogs on? I love e-collars. In fact, quite frankly, I think it's irresponsible to hunt a dog without one. Mm-hmm. However, I've seen more dogs ruined with improper e-collar introduction. And I warned Steve, I said, man, I would leave that to Aaron. Mm-hmm. I do not know how to do it, how to go about it. And I know I've seen a lot of ruined dogs. I would just leave that to the professionals.
So e-collars are tricky. They're an instant way to get a reaction from your dog. Right.
Good or bad. Yeah, you'll get a reaction for sure.
You press that button, and I just think it's overuse of the vitamin E that starts creating the negative reactions. What I like to tell people is, like, you know, put that collar on your wrist and figure out what numbers correspond to what level of stimulation, you know, is. I strapped it to my kid one time and had him run away.
Did you?
Yeah. It was pretty funny.
Did you get him back?
Oh, yeah. He stopped instantly. And so people need to understand how it works, and they need to understand the levels of stimulation that each collar provides, because every brand is different. Like a 2 on a Garmin might be a 3 on a sport dog, or vice versa. They're not consistent across the board.
Garmin, at least the ones I use, are pretty underpowered.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is good in my case. The 550 Wright Pro that I use to train, right, you have the low, the medium, and you press both buttons for the high stim.
Yeah.
And that's like, so you set it to a 3, you can get a low 3, a medium 3, and you press both and you get a super high 3, which might end up being like a 4 or 5.
Yeah.
And I used it on Fletch, but not in a way that was going to cause him any kind of discomfort. I used it with him on recall, but I had it set to 1.
Okay.
And like when I wanted him to have a recall, because when I first got him, he didn't really want to come. And I, you know, overlaid that with the whistle and a couple other things. It was set at 1. And I just did it like, I needed his head to come up to look at me.
Right.
And be like, oh, Aaron wants me to come back. That's what we focused on. And I think when you use an e-collar, and I think I've described this before, I don't know if it was here with you or not. It's like, I use e-collars as like parachutes, like pull in case of emergency.
That's a great, yeah.
Like everything's coming off the rails for me and I can't get the dog's attention any other way. Or I can't get it to respond to me in a way that I need.
Yeah.
Especially in an emergency, then I'm going to use that e-collar.
If I've got a dog that I've screwed up with an improper e-collar introduction, how do I get a hold of you?
You can just go to my website, battlebornbirddogs.com, and you guys can send me an email, or you can find me on Instagram, battlebornbirddogs, and send me an email there.
At battlebornbirddogs on Instagram. Well, Aaron, cannot thank you enough for doing this, man, and sincere thanks for all the help with Fletch.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
I really like it.
Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.